I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Vice President Pence, Defense Secretary Mattis, and other representatives of the U.S. government were in Europe over the weekend at the Munich Security Conference, assuring leaders that in spite of what President Trump has said about Russia, NATO, the EU, and Brexit, the U.S. views Europe as an ally. In Brussels yesterday, Pence said he favored the ouster of former NSA advisor Michael Flynn and said President Trump supports continued U.S. cooperation with Europe. The head of the European Council, Donald Tusk, worried that too much had happened and too much had been said to, quote, pretend that everything is as it used to be. We asked Judy Dempsey to join us. She's a non-resident senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, editor-in-chief of the Strategic Europe blog, also wrote a book called The Merkel Phenomenon. And Judy Dempsey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me begin with a clip of President Trump. He was speaking at a rally on Saturday, and then we'll talk about it.
You look at what's happening in Germany. You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible. You look at what's happening in Brussels. You look at what's happening all over the world. Take a look at Nice. Take a look at Paris.
President Trump was referring to an interview that he saw on Fox, an interview about an attack that never took place in Sweden.
Yes.
Also, an interview that has been repudiated, or at least the content of the interview about a video repudiated by Swedish leaders. Even some of the people featured in the video said that that was not a correct example of what they were saying. How did this play in Europe?
Well, it played comically and very harshly. It happened during the second day of the Munich Security Conference, and it went wild around the tweets. And the former Swedish Foreign Minister, Carl Bildt, was attending the conference, and he was actually very furious. And this is a kind of continuation of fake news, but more importantly, the feeling among European governments and leaders is that this fake news or this kind of way of presenting Europe is intrinsically anti-European, anti-EU, and is designed to kind of support the populist movements that are spreading throughout Europe.
Did he undercut his vice president, who was there to tell Europe, we're still your ally?
I have to be very honest about this. I don't think so. Mike Pence gave a rather... It wasn't quite hectoring a speech at the Munich Security Conference, and he kept reassuring allies, but you know, nearly every second paragraph referred back to his boss, President Donald Trump. I'm not so sure that Europeans were convinced. Pence had important stuff to say. Listen, Europeans, we are going to continue protecting you, security guarantee through NATO, but you've got to pay up. The old days are gone. The Europeans are trying to pay up, but they felt this hectoring and rather condescending attitude really didn't go down well. He reached out, but they're not convinced that when he goes back to Washington, the tone will revert back to Europe bashing. And this is, by the way, what happened in private talks by senior European diplomats who had visited the White House over the past week or two.
Why haven't European countries paid their NATO bills?
What are the NATO bills? I mean, they're beginning to pay. There's no bill. The condition, the agreement made at the Wales Summit in 2 years ago in Great Britain is NATO allies, pay up. Pay 2% of your defence budget, on 2% of your gross national budget on defence. Some of them are doing it. That's a lot of money, but they're slowly doing it, and I think actually there will be a bigger push now that Trump is very, very serious about this. To answer your question, the Europeans took the American security umbrella for granted, and they got lazy about it, and they just assumed America would always be there. I think those times are changing.
Tell me if I'm right or wrong here. It seemed that there were references to NATO, but did Pence or other members of the administration say anything about the EU? And there was a meeting in Brussels, also a meeting in Munich. Go ahead.
That's very interesting. The EU, well, it didn't really figure high among at least the government officials during the Munich conference. We had all the senators. And Senator Murphy spoke out in favor of the EU, and so did Senator and McCain. I mean, we had the other senators, sort of the flip side of the Trump administration, yeah, praising the European Union. And then, because of the fears of this rift in the transatlantic relationship, matters Pence went up to Brussels. And I don't envy him, because he has to see quite a mixture of very different leaders of the institutions in Brussels. But he tried to convey the message. And as the clip of Donald Tusk, president of the European Council that represents the 28 member states, said, well, a lot of water has been spilled already, and it's just not easy to continue as we were. So the feeling is not the best at the moment, and there's still a huge amount of distrust and suspicion. We are to blame as well, the Europeans. But Trump, as you know, one of the most important world leaders, I wonder, is this the best way to treat your old European allies?
Interesting. What you mentioned, that you feel like Europe has played a role in some of the problems, tensions, conflicts between Europe and the U.S. In what way?
Europe is a difficult continent, and it's very difficult to get all the 28 member states to agree on all sorts of things. We have been discussing an asylum policy for near to 25 years, and a refugee policy, and we've been discussing all sorts of ways of intelligence sharing and increasing our defence and security policies. And it's been slow and sluggish, and Americans in some ways have been patient with us, but I think the time has come for the reckoning. And Trump is, I think, laying it down very firmly to the Europeans. You've got to pay up now. There's one very important point that has to be made, and the Europeans are not convinced, and particularly the Germans. The Europeans are not convinced that Trump supports the idea of the EU. He prefers dealing with nation states. And this is the big problem. It was the Americans who helped build the European Union after World War II, and now it is the Americans who are beginning to question, well, is this EU really necessary?
And that was certainly the president's support for Brexit, Europe, England leaving the EU.
Absolutely. But, I mean, President Trump has spoken critically has criticized the EU. You know, is it really necessary? And the Brits were right to leave. And he courts the head of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage, and others. And Marine Le Pen, the populist leader of France, says, yes, Trump is the way, America first. Well, why not France first and Holland first? And, I mean, you know what happened when the Germans said Germany, über alles, Germany first, in the interwar years. And, I mean, Europeans are very, very worried about this. If Europe devolves or descends into a collection of nation states, this would lead to enormous instability and a rise of distrust among countries which actually overcame this huge centuries distrust precisely because of the European Union and with support of successive American administrations.
What is the status of Angela Merkel in Europe, and how is she viewed? I know she's got an upcoming election. And she welcomed immigrants, migrants, refugees to Germany, frankly, with open arms.
Well, yes. Well, the borders are getting tougher now, the external borders and everything. But it's now, for the first time in her third office, as she prepares for her fourth re-election campaign, she's facing real opposition. The former president of the European Parliament, a man called Manfred Schulz, and head of the Social Democrats, and he's going in. He wants to be chancellor. The polls have shot up for the Social Democrats, who have been Merkel's coalition partners. It's too early to say. She still has an awful lot of support for her refugee policy, still, the huge amount of civil society organizations. But there's a part of society and the electorate that says enough is enough. It's fine we welcoming the refugees. Why don't the other 27 EU countries carry the burden as well? And that's the issue now. Solidarity, support. I mean, if we're one European Union, let's share the burden. It's a bit like defence spending. Share the defence spending for the Americans, share the burden of the refugees for the Europeans.
And do you think that will happen?
No.
No.
I don't think
in
it will
word,
happen.
No.
In a word, no. Endless discussions about this. There's the usual countries that take in the refugees, Sweden and a few others. But this is election year. And refugee issues, migration, the Islam terrorist threat, these are the big issues. The identity and religious and ethnic issues are now playing a role. Not very strongly in Germany yet. And neither the established parties don't want want to get into this, to their credit. And they're very... it's very interesting that the populist, anti-Islam, anti-EU party, the Alternative for Deutschland, has really slumped in the polls. Merkel, never underestimate her. She's keeping quiet at the moment. Mm. There's several months to go before the elections. It's wise to never speculate here with the German politics.
I do want to talk about French politics. They also have an election coming up. You mentioned Marine Le Pen. What is the appeal, you think? And we're going to be talking about populism in the United States, but what is the appeal of populism in Europe today? And even how do you and others define it?
The appeal of populism is a reaction, first of all, to open borders. It's a reaction to globalization. It's a reaction fed by, I must say, very well-off populist leaders to those who feel they've been left behind. Most populist leaders in France and in Germany and in the Netherlands and in Italy and in Greece and in Britain, they're quite well-off, frankly. I don't think they've ever joined an unemployment queue or ever entered an unemployment office. But they are articulate and they've got funds. And now they have President Trump that's supporting these breakaway movements in the EU. And on the other side, President Putin would like a weaker EU as well. Driving them is all these things, this return to the nation state, this rejection of Brussels, this belief that national sovereignty and bilateral trade deals is a thing that will fix everything. But the reality is that globalization is so complex and everything is so now knitted together that the nation state is part of this package and it cannot go it alone. But it's a combination of all these things. The other element is the actual slowness of the elites across Europe to recognize the huge youth unemployment and the kind of restrictions that would let the economy sort of stimulate growth. I'm talking about regulations, restrictions, certain ways of dealing with more flexible employment. I think the leaders do realize this now, but they're very careful because they want to keep a kind of social net, a social cushion for people. So it's out there for grabs, but the established leaders really don't take on the populists.
An unfair question at the very end of our interview, Judy Dempsey, about 30 seconds, but do you see Europe in crisis?
Oh, yes. It's in a great crisis. Will it get out of this crisis? If you're an optimist, yes, it'll take some time. I'm not going to say I'm a pessimist.
Are you an optimist?
I'm cautiously optimistic that Marine Le Pen will not win the French election, and I'm cautiously optimistic that Europe will turn around slowly.
Well, Judy Dempsey, I really appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much.
A big pleasure, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Judy Dempsey, a non-resident senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, editor-in-chief of the Strategic Europe blog, also wrote a book called The Merkel Phenomenon. And yes, we will be talking about populism in this country after this very short break. Do stay with us. Also call our comment line or text it, 267-405-2006. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We were just talking about populist movements in Europe. The 2016 presidential election featured two candidates with populist appeal. Bernie Sanders criticized the rigged system that advantaged the wealthy and well-connected. Donald Trump told his supporters that immigrants, trade deals, China, and Mexico were largely responsible for their economic plight. Our guest John Judas traces the rise of populism beginning in the U.S. heartland in the 19th century to today in his new book. It's called The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. John Judas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be there.
So what ties, I guess, left-wing and right-wing populism? And we were just talking with our other guests who talked about populism in Europe, concerns about open borders and globalization and being left behind and economy and unemployment. Are these the things that tie the left and the right together?
I think at the center of both Trump, Marine Le Pen, Bernie Sanders, Podemos in Spain, which is a left-wing group, is a distinction between the people and the elite or establishment, that there's a conflict between the two. How the politician or the party defines the people or the elite, again, depends upon the time and circumstances and also on some underlying political slant. Trump, in his inaugural address and again in Melbourne, talked about Washington as the elite and or as the media as the elite, and promised to defend the people against them. Sanders talked about the billionaire class. So there's this there's this conflict. You know, liberals or progressives promise to reconcile all interests with a view towards helping the poor and the working class. But again, reconciliation, accommodation is central to it. Populists, no. Conflict, polarization. And one of the surprising things I think about Trump to me is that since he's become president, when you become president, you become, in effect, the establishment. He's continued to play the populist tune as president.
Well, it's interesting. He does certainly play the populist tune, and I guess by that we mean using the language of populism, but his administration is filled with millionaires and even billionaires. How do you reconcile that, John Judas, when in understanding what populism is and its appeal?
Well, you know, that's his problem to explain, but what's so striking is that he has continued to promote conflict, polarization, with the idea that he is speaking on behalf of a silent majority that will really have its way within the country. Now he has to also appease the Republican leadership. Some of the people he's nominated, the guy who got kicked out as Labor Secretary, Betsy DeVos, are more out of the conventional Republican, either Chamber of Commerce or religious right mold. You know, in terms of his pitch and what he's proposed, he attacked the drug companies for their prices.
That's right.
He's continued to call on companies not to move their plants south of the border or overseas and leave workers in the lurch. And he's also, and this is another part that's central to the right-wing varieties of populism, but not the left, scapegoated illegal immigrants. I'm not going to tell you that the United States doesn't have a problem with illegal immigration and that we shouldn't have secure borders. But I was struck by his, for instance, saying that the reason Hillary Clinton got a larger popular margin was 5 million illegal immigrants voted. Now, that's a form of scapegoating, and that, again, is characteristic more of the right-wing rather than the left-wing varieties of populism.
Well, just using that as an example, are you saying that right-wing populists either misrepresent the truth or exaggerate things or say things that are untrue compared to left-wing? Because from all examinations, we didn't have millions of illegal immigrants voting on Election Day.
Well, I think that's true with Trump. And I think that what you find with Trump and to some extent also with Marine Le Pen is that populism has a third term. It's not only the people versus the elite, but it's the idea that the elite or the establishment are coddling this third group. And it can be African Americans in the case of George Wallace, or it can be Muslims and asylum seekers or illegal immigrants. So I think that's the third term. And again, I could imagine a more centrist populism, for instance, the Finns, where their program is to have a immigration program like Canada does that gives priority to skilled immigrants and so on. So it's not integral to populism that the appeals be false, that they be based on a certain scapegoating. But that's the case certainly with Trump.
Well, you talk about the present-day rise of populism in this country and other countries as well, that you can trace it back to the 2008 recession. Certainly the Tea Party grew out of that. Occupy Wall Street grew out of the bank bailouts, the Affordable Care Act, the auto industry bailout. I think there's also this sense of the fact of an economy that really wasn't helping support a middle-class lifestyle. Do you see all those features still at work?
Yes, and that's the freaky thing about these populist parties and candidates. You can say, well, one's on the left and one's on the right, and I've made that distinction. But if you actually look again at Trump, you see features that are very common with Sanders and with labor and left-wing Democrats. The rejection of NAFTA, complaints about China using its currency deals to get rid of 5 million American manufacturing jobs in the last 15 years. With Marine Le Pen, her domestic program is probably to the left of the Democratic Party in the United States. So these are freaky kind of parties that don't develop in normal times, particularly in the United States, where we don't have a multi-party system. And they reflect the breakdown of a prevailing consensus among both parties, among the, in case the United States, the Democrats and the Republicans, in Europe, Christian Democrats, Social Democrats, that the main parties aren't dealing with the underlying issues. And in this case, the underlying issues, again, are globalization, an economic policy that's based to a great extent on deregulation, reduction of taxes above, and the promise of prosperity hasn't been delivered. And that's why you see these this breakout on both the left and the right.
So these are messages, the sort of rise of populism. These are messages to the two, in this country, two mainstream parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party?
Yes, I call them early warning signals. The original populist party in the United States in the 1890s was a very early warning system that the laissez-faire system, just let corporations develop the way they want, have a chaotic banking system, that wasn't working. It took maybe 10, 20, 30 years for the populist program to get enacted, but it was a first warning that something was wrong. United States, Europe, yes, there's something wrong. In Europe, the euro is pretty much proved dysfunctional as a currency. I don't know what they're going to do about it. I don't know how to resolve this problem. But the one result has been this immense poverty and depression on the order of our Great Depression in southern Europe, in Greece, Italy, Spain, to some extent, in Portugal, which has sparked a populism from the left. So there are real problems, and I don't know. We don't know yet what the resolution is going to look like. But this kind of immense mess, Judy Dempsey said, crisis. There is a crisis in both countries, a political crisis, and that's a sign that the old ways are not working.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's John Judas joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. We're talking about a book that came out just a couple of months ago called The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can also call our comment line. You can also text it. You can call and leave a message, and that comment line is 267-405-2006. Again, 267-405-2006. Your book looks at the history of populism. First of all, you say populism really is an American idea, something I guess we have exported to Europe. It began in the 19th century, began in the middle part of the United States. Was it about economic dislocation and anxiety?
It was about the farmers feeling that they were getting screwed. They couldn't repay their loans to the banks at the time. There wasn't a Federal Reserve system. And if there was a drought, if the farmers got in trouble, they found themselves foreclosed immediately. They were also victims of the railroads who were overpricing transporting the goods from the south and the west to the east and for export. So it was a uprising, and it united temporarily for a while both the Midwest, and we're talking mainly about the plain states too, Kansas, Nebraska, states that are now pretty much Republican states, with the South, and with the promise for a while even of a multiracial kind of movement in the South, which was destroyed in the late 19th century by the racist Southern Democratic Party.
And how did the government respond? And I think that's sort of a critical question that we can also apply to today. How did the government respond to the crisis that people were experiencing, especially farmers in the Midwest? And do the populist parties or movements of today, are they asking government to do something?
Well, you have to go a ways, because the initial response is the rise of progressivism and of progressive republicanism and the Democratic Party, Woodrow Wilson. And so you get the creation of the Federal Reserve System in the 1910s. You get a graduated income tax, which was, again, a proposal of the populace. You get the direct election of senators. The real the full populist program you only get really during the New Deal, which really comes about in the face of the Great Depression. And the Great Depression is the final breakdown of this laissez-faire system. And that's when you get the real regulation of the banking system as we know it, although it somewhat gets deregulated in the 1990s. So that's it took a while for us to see a really new kind of, so you could pull it state capitalism, New Deal liberalism, to arise out of these early protests of the populace.
Well, it's interesting to think about then deregulation. Certainly President Trump has already taken steps to deregulate parts of the economy. Does this have populist appeal as you understand it?
I think more that what you're seeing there is he's operating on two channels. I mean, he is a multi-dimensional politician. He was once a moderate Democrat. He's also, in some respects, a business Republican, and the emphasis on lowering taxes for corporations, deregulation, his policies on energy. Very much are in line with a business Republican approach. So, you're getting a mélange with Trump. But as I was saying, the political appeal he's making still is strongly populist. The question with Trump politically is to what extent he is going to give in to both the business Republican side and to the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate. On things like repealing and replacing Obamacare. He promises a system that's just as good. I have my doubts. The leadership in the House would like to privatize parts of Medicare and Social Security. Trump promised in his campaign to protect those. Will he continue to do it? So, again, I think you're going to see a conflict in his administration between his populist appeal and the sort of business republicanism that's part of him, and that's certainly part of the reigning Republican Party in Congress.
President Trump recently called the press the enemy of the people. I remember Vice President Agnew talking about the press. I think it was some like nattering nabobs of negativism. George Wallace talked about pointy-headed liberals. You mentioned this earlier, and let me also add the judiciary. President Trump and even candidate Trump was specifically critical of certain judges because he didn't like their rulings. And again, I keep going back to this populist appeal. This obviously appeals to President Trump. Does it also appeal to his supporters?
Yeah, you left out pusillanimous pussyfooters. That was one of my favorite.
I didn't trust myself to say that, but no, go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, I screwed it up too, so it's all right.
Nattering nabobs is hard enough. No, but go ahead.
Going after the press again is not exclusive to Republicans, again, you have to remember Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt in 1930, going after the judiciary, Roosevelt in 1937. You know, the press stuff can prove very dangerous. I don't like to get into this whole Putin business, but, you know, that was a central part of his trying to consolidate his rule, was suppressing the press in Russia, and it goes on there. So, you know, there's something scary about it, but attacking the press and actually starting to attempt to restrict its purview to suppress it is something else, and we're just going to have to see. And if that happens, I would hope there will be an uprising in the country.
About a minute before our break, is there anything new about what we now call fake news?
Oh, you know, it's a lot of it has existed for, you know, 500 years since there was a printing press. And a lot of our elections, in the early elections, were fought over, you know, claims about parentage and adultery and things like that. You know, going back to the early 19th century, miscegenation was a big issue. So that's not new, but the, you know, the internet adds a whole new dimension in terms of the proliferation of fake news.
That's John Judis, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. And again, lines open. You can call our comment line, and that phone number is 267-405-2006. You can also text it as well. Call and leave a comment. Also, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you make of populism as you see it. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, John Judis is joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We're talking about populism on the left, populism on the right, and we've been touching a bit on what's been happening in Europe and certainly what's happening in this country as well under President Trump. And you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can also call and leave a message at our comment line. You can also text us at that comment line in the number again, 267-405-2006. Dan from Roxborough, has a comment. Can your guest comment on the link between right-wing populism and cultural narcissism? And I'm not exactly sure what Dan means by cultural narcissism, but perhaps this idea of the U.S. having a certain kind of culture, perhaps a more sort of Western white culture. Can you comment on that, John Judis?
Well, look, it's a short answer, but I'll give you I'll just say something about it that, you know, I've seen a lot of these articles about Trump being mentally ill and or even, you know, crazy, and bringing in all kinds of diagnoses about narcissism and stuff. I think that's a real distraction. You could say that. I've seen it about all our presidents. I remember people saying it about Bill Clinton. That's my medium answer to the question.
But you're saying it's just not helpful to have that conversation?
Well, look, I think mental illness is a social category. It's not a biological category. It can be caused by biological illness. But the basic thing that marks off somebody who is, let's say, psychotic from everybody else is they're incapable of working and playing. Trump is certainly capable of doing his job in life. So, again, leave off these kind of crazy diagnoses and concentrate on what's wrong with what the guy is doing.
Well, let me ask you, because it's clear you or anyone, you can watch the rallies or even go to those rallies, and you see a great deal of passion and support for now President Trump. If we're thinking of that as a form of a populist movement, what is the pressure for him to deliver on those things that he said he would do?
Well, I think there's a lot of pressure. The thing that watch again about Trump is the interaction between his movement and the movement opposing him. What I worry about most with Trump is a kind of scenario where we are going to have terrorist attacks in the United States. No question. It would surprise me very much if in the next 4 years we don't have another Orlando or San Bernardino. Mm. What's his response going to be? What's he going to tell his followers? Then there'll be demonstrations. How's he going to respond to the demonstrations? And I could see a very nasty cycle beginning right there, and one that could lead to some kind of curtailment of our democracy.
Let's talk, though, about the more liberal populist movements. I think both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren probably representing that for either for their party or what's perhaps left of the Democratic Party. I'm not sure. How do you see their influence? And you mentioned about the sort of pushback to President Trump. And of course, all those protests that we've seen for the last month are probably a good example of that. But how do you see Warren and even Sanders remaking the Democratic Party?
Boy, that's a hard question.
Why is that a hard question? Curious.
Because, a few things. Let me say one thing. I think Bernie Sanders, if he had gotten the nomination, would have had a very hard time winning the election.
Against Trump?
Yes, against Trump. And the thing I would cite is what happened in Colorado. Colorado, again, is becoming a blue state. I guess it's purple going on blue. Very liberal state. And in Colorado, they had a referendum on having a single-payer system to replace their existing health care system, where basically the Colorado state government would pay for health care and taxes would have to be raised. The leading Democrats opposed it. Business opposed it. Unions were split. It lost something like 80 to 20. It just got slaughtered. And so, what I worried about, again, with Sanders is if he actually got in a national election and the issues of taxes and spending and big government came up, he would have had a very hard time. And I say that as somebody who completely supports having a single-payer system in the United States. So I think the main terrain on which the Democrats can rebound is defense, not offense, at this point. Not in terms of some far-reaching program, something that maybe we're going to have in 2024, 2028, if we're lucky. But again, defending the people who are going to lose insurance if Obamacare gets repealed, defending the Medicare and Social Security, those kind of things will be central to a Democratic revival. And if Trump oversteps in those areas, I think you're going to see a real revival of the Democrats in 2018.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Mike in Wilmington. Mike says, people yearn for excitement and anything to hit the streets and rallies for, throw in a relative economic downturn, and we are off to the races. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Well, I think, again, I think if the economy turns downward during Trump's tenure, he's going to have trouble. There's no question about it. I mean, that was the downturn in 1991 was the basis for the initial populist explosion in the United States, Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan in 1992. And Bill Clinton, in many ways, took over Perot's program. His theme song was "People, not people before profits." So every time this has happened, except in 2001, where you had the 9/11 interrupting things and people being focused on a foreign threat, that has resulted in questions being raised about the prevailing economic wisdom. And if Trump can't deliver, if there really is a downturn, he'll be in political trouble.
Do you think he has to build the wall, which we're finding out is going to cost a lot of money?
Oh, I think he can finesse that.
You do?
Oh, sure. I mean, he'll build a wall in parts, and there'll be a fence in others, and there'll be National Guard. And, I suspect, given the way they're dealing with deportation, that he's going to be able to claim a big reduction in illegal immigration across the border.
So you see,
and that will certainly appease his constituency.
You see a lot of people being deported, as you.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the numbers there. I mean, Obama deported a lot of people, and he deported people who were guilty of crimes. Now, it seems like from the leaks that Trump is going to go beyond that and deport people who've been in the country less than 2 years. So we'll just have to see.
Let me get a call from our comment line. Let's listen to Paul from Center City.
Hello, my name is Paul, calling from Center City. I hope that when you talk about populism, you include the racism that's part of it here and in France. In any case, Washington Post just reports 170 Jewish tombstones knocked over someplace in Missouri by people who would probably call themselves populists.
Thanks, Paul, for calling into Radio Times. Is there an element of racism, John Judas, when we talk about populism?
That's what he asked, isn't it? Because I couldn't hear the question itself.
Oh, you couldn't. I'm sorry.
But that's okay. I'm going to just take what you asked. Is that all right?
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. Now, go ahead.
Sure. The constituency that Trump draws upon really begins with George Wallace, and you could locate it then in his following in 1968-1972. More male than female, older rather than younger, at the time only a high school graduation. Now it's maybe gone to some college or a modest college. And feeling besieged both from above and below by an elite that pays less taxes than it deserves, than it ought to, but at the same time an elite that is, at the time in 1968-1972, helping African Americans at the expense of the white middle class, let's say in Boston, in the busing crisis, where kids from white working class neighborhoods were bused to black neighborhoods and vice versa, but the suburbs, the wealthy suburbs, were left alone. So that constituency sort of has gone through the electorate like a big animal might go through a python, and it changes its focus at times. At times it's the Christian Coalition. At times it's an anti-tax movement. What distinguishes the present is that two things have really come to the surface. First is the economic grievances, which are absolutely real. If you look at Trump's vote and if you look at the swing states that he won, and you can match that up with the states that lost manufacturing from 2000 to 2015. The first state was Michigan, but oddly enough, people never guess this, is the second was North Carolina, the furniture industry. So, again, there is a major economic grievance that's at work in Trump's constituency as well as in Sanders. But in addition, there's a kind of fusion of the fear of terrorists coming into the country with a rejection of the idea that we don't have secure borders.
And all of that.
I'm sorry, I'm saying the opposite. A rejection of any kind of open borders.
What?
And the idea that we have to enforce our borders and that we can't allow illegal immigrants to stream into the country. So you get a fusion of that fear with economic grievances, and that's what really characterizes the Trump vote.
And that's actually what our first guest said about Europe and the concern of a kind of borderless part of the world and that leading to some rise in Europe of some of these more right-wing populist movements. I do remember Patrick Buchanan saying a country that loses control of its borders is not a country anymore, which sounds very much like what candidate and President Trump has said. Let me read a couple of comments here. A tweet from Ken. Historically, what kind of actions or movements have stopped progressive populism? And how can that relate to today? A tweet from Lojo. Wasn't it populism, nationalism, and press suppression that led to World War II? Any future war predictions? And I see a lot of concern from a number of our email comments and tweet comments as well about what this all means. And where do you think this populist movement is taking us, John Judas?
Well, which one?
that's true. Well, you talked a little bit about the left saying that they're going to have to kind of play defense, at least for the next couple of years.
Yes.
And I guess the question is what happens on the other side? And if the populist movement is represented by the Republican Party, you've got both houses of Congress and obviously you've got the president of the United States.
I don't want to depress your readers, but listeners. Look, if you look at Europe, the left-wing populist parties have had a lot of trouble. Syriza in Greece came to power on a promise to resist the Troika, which is the IMF, the European Central Bank, the European Commission. You could put it in general as the EU leadership. They weren't going to accept the onerous terms of a bailout, which, you know, was involved in turning the Greece into basically an underdeveloped country with 25-30% unemployment, beggars on the street, what have you. They came into power and they found they couldn't resist. And so they became, in effect, a shadow of the Socialist Party that they had displaced. And they're probably going to get kicked out of power the next election in Greece. Podemos in Spain has had a lot of trouble defining what it's doing. Again, I think the advantage of the right-wing populist groups in Northern Europe and in the United States talking about Trump is that they can play their scapegoat card and stay in power if they can maintain a certain level of prosperity in the country.
And not necessarily an easy thing to do. But do you, and we're almost out of time here, but do you worry about fascism?
Well, I don't worry about fascism in the classical sense. Fascism in the 1920s was an expansionist movement. It was a movement in Germany that wanted to create a Third Reich in Italy to restore the Roman Empire. And I think what distinguishes these movements and parties and candidates in the United States and Western Europe is that they're contractionary. They're nationalist, even in a narrow sense of the word. I mean, Trump doesn't want to take over Mexico. He wants to keep Mexicans out of the country. So in that sense, we're not seeing a repeat of the 1920s, 1930s style of fascism.
And we have to sadly have to end on that note. John Judas, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's the author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.